You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you are interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you are free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. This week, we spoke with Firehawk, who is an anarchist and anti-prison and anti-carceral state organizer based out of Colorado. In this interview, we talk about her zine, Governing Bodies, Governing Souls, Female Incarceration, Rehabilitation, and Promising Radical Strategies, which came out of her experiences conducting research into increasing rates of incarceration in women's prison in the U.S. We talk about those experiences, about the zine in general, and about possible ways to be of support to incarcerated people and to anti-carceral struggles. We also talk about the various ways in which incarceration of transgender people are represented or thought about, a topic not necessarily included in the zine. If you have any opinions about how we discuss this topic, I would love to hear them. Additionally, if you have a take on this issue that we did not touch on or more information that we didn't consider, please don't hesitate to drop us an email at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net, or you can email me directly, this is William, by the way, at stormwater@riseup.net, or you can email Firehawk directly at firehawk666@riseup.net. But before that interview, here are some announcements from the Transmission Prison Project. There will be a volunteer interest meeting for the Asheville-based group, the Transmission Prison Project, on Wednesday, June 29th at 7 p.m. sharp in the upstairs room of the West Asheville Izzy's at 373 Haywood Road. The Transmission Prison Project is a volunteer-run group which sends books and zines to LGBTQI prisoners, all free of charge. To get in touch with them, you can email them at transmissionprisonproject@gmail.com, and transmission has a Z in it, by the way, or search for them on Facebook. And another announcement from our comrades at Anti-Phoenix. This was communicated to The Final Straw from these folks who have been facing government and police oppression in the form of an initiative called Operation Phoenix, which specifically targets anarchists in the Czech Republic. Quote, as Czech Anarchist Black Cross and the Anti-Phoenix Collective, we call for international solidarity actions against the repression of anarchists in the so-called Czech Republic. This repressive wave is labeled Operation Phoenix. 8 people are accused or charged, some with possible life sentences, and with many more harassed by police, interrogated, raided, and devices having been confiscated. Our call for international solidarity is to support all of the charged and affected, but also in particular to support Martin, an anarchist who is entrapped and accused of preparation of a terrorist attack, all actually having been planned by 2 state infiltrators. He has been locked away for almost 14 months already in some pretty terrible conditions, and in response, he has just gone on hunger strike. Especially in places where you have Czech embassies or consulates, you can show that borders can't stop anarchist solidarity. End quote. To learn more about this, you can visit antiphoenix.noblogs.org.
A sentencing date for the vegan anarchist prisoner Eric King has been set for Tuesday, June 28th at 11:30 a.m. at the U.S. District Courthouse in Kansas City, Missouri. Eric accepted a non-cooperating plea for federal arson charges. He was convicted of attempting to set fire to a congressman's office. If you'd like to attend his sentencing, it's suggested that you arrive by 11 a.m. at courtroom 8A at 400 East 9th Street in Kansas City, Missouri, with a valid state-issued ID and a plan to go through metal detectors. There's a request for fundraising for his expected 8-year sentence, support t-shirts, his current mailing address, details on his case, and more that you can find at supporterickking.org. The Industrial Workers of the World Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee is requesting folks to email and call WAUPIN, that's W-A-U-P-U-N, Correctional Institution in Wisconsin, today and Monday, June 20th. The hunger strike that has been ongoing involves 5 prisoners and is focused on an end to the practice of long-term solitary confinement in the state of Wisconsin. As of Sunday, today, people have been on hunger strike in WAUPIN for 13 days. One of the hunger strikers, Cesar De Leon, announced on June 15th that he is now also refusing water because WAUPIN's water supply is contaminated with lead. He vomits up their water and experiences stomach pain and heartburn when he drinks it. You can email brian.foster@wisconsin.gov or call Brian Foster at 920-324-5571 to express your solidarity with the prisoners on strike, including Cesar De Leon, and concerns around the effects of long-term solitary confinement and the quality of water present there. If you wish to write to participating prisoners and make a message of support, you can visit our blog for the addresses of the prisoners to offer support. And now for a message from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We'll come like a wall. Let me tell you about the case of Aaron Dietrich. Aaron was tortured, betrayed, and drugged into a life sentence for a crime he provably didn't commit. Here's how it went down. There was a guy who came up dead, beaten to death. Turns out the guy had brought charges against a one-time love interest of Aaron Dietrich. So, investigators looked into Aaron. They took his DNA and fingerprints and looked into his story. Turns out Aaron was on security footage at Walmart when the killing went down. Not that shopping at Walmart isn't a crime in itself. Time went by and investigators continued to harass Aaron and his friends so thoroughly that it drove Aaron to relapse. 8 months after the killing, cops descended on Aaron in a SWAT van and took him to the county jail. There, they gave him a urinalysis and found that he was hooked on heroin. That's when they employed what the CIA manuals refer to as the simple torture situation. Without any valid justification, jail officials held Aaron in total isolation and denied him medical assistance for heroin withdrawals. In the midst of that pain, he soiled himself and was denied a change of clothes or a shower. He was refused phone access. Completely isolated, his cell was unbearably hot, and prison staff continuously rattled his cell door, depriving him of sleep, telling him again and again that he was going to die in the death chamber if he didn't do the right thing. It was made clear to him that he would not get medical attention or a shower or a change of clothes or even sleep unless he confessed. So, with his will broken and in the depths of heroin withdrawals, Aaron requested a chance to speak with detectives so he could make a false confession. And detectives were there within 15 minutes. Once Aaron made the false confession and implicated himself in a crime he really didn't commit, Auglaize County jail staff immediately transferred Aaron to the population cell. He was given a shower and clean clothes and access to a phone. He was even treated for heroin withdrawals, all of the things that had been withheld from him in order to make him confess. But wait, it gets better. When Aaron finally spoke to his attorneys in this death penalty case, they didn't immediately seek to suppress the false confession that was provably gained through deliberate torture. Instead, they doubled down on the confession. Attorneys told Aaron that the other 2 kids, both supposedly linked to the killing, were also giving confessions. The attorneys told Aaron that he was competing to see who could tell a better story. They told Aaron that it was in his best interest to incriminate himself and others in order to get the best deal. 20 minutes after meeting with counsel, Aaron was sitting in front of investigators on video, answering every question fully. At one point, investigators got angry and stormed out, and Aaron, still on video, looked to his counsel for advice on how to make the story more sensational. No kidding. Later on, the same attorneys who told Aaron to incriminate himself would say that it was impossible to defend him, that the false confession that they forced him to give had destroyed his chances of winning. Aaron realized too late that he had been tricked and exploited, but when he still insisted on fighting the frame-up, jailed doctors put him on a cocktail of drugs, all of which have the known side effects of diminishing a subject's ability to assert his will. So, hopped up on a whole smorgasbord of goofballs, Aaron was pressured into pleading guilty to a crime he provably did not commit. Aaron is now seeking to withdraw that plea that is the result of torture and ineffective assistance of counsel and deliberate drugging. Hopefully his materials will be made available through SeanSwain.org. By July 1st, you can support Aaron in his struggle for freedom. Facebook.com, Aaron Dietrich, and YouTube.com, Free Aaron Dietrich. And you can also support him on Twitter at #TeamDietrich. Also, look for him at GoFundMe.com. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional Institution in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org. First of all, would you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do and what projects you're involved in?
Sure. My name is Firehawk, and I'm based out of Colorado. And a lot of the work I do is based on basically carceral systems and the ways in which, women, especially poor women, are locked up in cages or locked up in communities. And the kinds of projects that I do, I first off work with women who are currently incarcerated in the state of Colorado, and we do a sort of political education class, and it's targeted really towards people who have experienced severe trauma and violence, which nearly 100% of people incarcerated in women's facilities have. So that's first, and that group is called WEBS, Women Empowered Building Support. And then I also work on this new prisoner publication that is by and for folks who are incarcerated across the United States, and specifically those who identify as women or trans or non-binary, gender non-conforming.
And that's the Unstoppable Project, right?
Oh, yeah, it is the Unstoppable Project. we just put out our first edition of Unstoppable, and that is the winter 2016 edition. You can hit us up on our website and get a fancy glossy one. And we're actually about to put all that stuff into the mailbox and send it to our first 300 a subscription request from folks who are in lockdown right now.
What led you to, or what started the Unstoppable Project?
Well, I mean, basically, I have been working with folks who've been locked down for a long time, and just, with a couple of friends had sort of, really wanted to highlight the resistance that happened in women's facilities, especially, or among folks who identify as trans feminine. And so, because, there have been a slew of anti-authoritarian publications coming out written by or for prisoners, but again, it sort of highlights one specific kind of resistance that happens in men's facilities. And we just wanted to sort of expand that and contribute to the conversation in a different way. That's what got that going.
Definitely. I a couple years ago, listened in on a workshop done by two folks in Chapel Hill about the increasing rates of incarceration for like women and female assigned populations, and was like quite shocked to hear that, like you said before, that nearly 100% of people who are in women's facilities report instances of violence or like sexual assault. And I remember this moment in the workshop where people were like, yeah, this group of 2,000 randomly sampled people in women's prison were asked this question like all across the United States, and 98% of them reported instances of violence and like sexual assault. So
yeah, it goes deep. I mean, oftentimes this starts in the home by either a family member or a friend of the family. You know, in speaking to a lot of incarcerated women, this is what they say, and that also it continues on in their adult lives. And you know, when you think about, let's say, you know, racialized women in their communities who are also sort of experiencing violence by strangers, you know, aka the cops or other state actors, you know, the violence just keeps on overlapping. And, you know, in terms of incarceration, I mean, trying to deal with trauma and violence while you're locked down in a cage only worsens the problem.
Certainly not a super conducive environment to that sort of thing. That's what I hear.
Yeah.
So I am really interested in talking to you about your zine called Governing Bodies, Governing Souls, Female Incarceration, Quote, Rehabilitation, and Promising Radical Struggles. Will you speak about your own experiences entangling with state systems like this? And will you talk about what led you to write this zine?
Yeah, sure. So I myself have had a long history of violence, both, you know, experiencing it and also inflicting it on other people, drug issues, some issues with, you know, mental health and neurodivergence. And then also I experienced I spent about a year in a county jail. And, you know, basically I, you know, grew up in a really poor household, and my father abused me quite severely until my mom kicked him out of the home when I was 10. And soon after that, you know, my mother passed away actually. And I just sort of like, you know, hit this, this wall and started tumbling downwards and tried to relieve the pain. And I fell into some crowds who were using drugs, dealing drugs. And I eventually, started using heroin pretty severely. And basically for me to survive, and at the time I was also living in my dad's house, you know, I had to, that was a very unsafe place for me to be. And so I ended up, you know, just running away and lived with this older guy who was supplying drugs for me. And, you know, that was my way of sort of, you know, keeping my head clean, because this guy was providing a roof over my head. And I basically shoplifted a bunch and got caught a lot. Wasn't very good, and ended up, you know, serving a bid in my local county jail on the East Coast. And while I was there, you know, I saw a lot of f-ing pain, and ended up, you know, making really close friendships, and was actually quite surprised at community that folks built on the inside, just because, you know, without even speaking a word to our history or our traumas, we all knew that we shared that. And so the ways in which people, you know, tried to have each other's backs was just amazing, you know. And I don't want to glorify it, because there's also a lot of backbiting, but, you know, seeing that was hugely inspiring. And then also witnessing some, you know, close homies who ended up losing their kids because, you know, they were locked down for 15 months. And at that point, the state can get involved and determine whether or not they're going to take away permanent custody rights. And so coming out of that, I was just really motivated to work with this population And in terms of writing the zine, Governing Bodies, Governing Souls, I ended up going to graduate school and doing some research on rehabilitation systems and realized how much of a different kind of social control system that is, and wanted to try to merge my own personal history and some of my observations with my critiques of how the state is trying to propose solutions to the problem.
And there seems to be a huge tension between, I mean, obviously there's a huge tension between the stated intent of rehabilitation facilities such as prison and like how it actually goes down. The format of the zine is also really interesting. It's basically broken up into two like vague sections that like intertwine with each other a bunch. And the one is like an ethnographic study and it's written like from a third person perspective. And the other one is an account of your own personal experiences with it. And I really appreciated that too. What led you into the choice to do that instead of having it be just an ethnographic study?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think for me, sort of, you know, coexisting in anarchist spaces and then also academic spaces, I see so many huge problems with how researchers go about researching things, you know, and there's very much a distanced, objective voice that's written into the text that doesn't really speak to me. And for this, I really wanted to sort of have some of the things that I observed in terms of state violence and in terms of interpersonal violence, I wanted to sort of have it intersect with my own experience and see where those things overlap and where my experiences as a young, childless white person, how those experiences diverged and how they were different. And so, you know, I'm just really interested in, you know, taking a somewhat of an objective approach just to sort of get a lay of the land. But, you know, also I think what people really relate to are the personal stories, because I think, you know, at this point, so many of us know people who have lived hard lives and have been criminalized.
Definitely. I definitely really appreciated that choice on your part, too. I was wondering if you would talk a little bit more about, you mentioned the like forms of social control in grad school. Did you feel as though the grad school was trying to force you into only providing a certain kind of viewpoint or perspective, or were they forcing you into some sort of political agenda with your work? And or how did that go down for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my whole experience in grad school was a struggle because, you know, I felt as though I was constantly trying to appease my committee members, right? So, you know, five formally trained elite academics who are consistently like judging my work. You know, I did feel as though I had to step back from my more direct and overt political agenda and instead sort of mask my language in theoretical frameworks for it to fly, right? So if I cited Foucault a bunch or maybe even Marx a bunch, you know, then that added some legitimacy to my words as opposed to me as a, you know, formally incarcerated, politicized person. I didn't always feel as though I had something to say from my own viewpoint. And so the shackles are free now, and I'm taking a lot of liberties with that nowadays.
That's awesome. Were you anarchist identified when you were in grad school?
I was, yeah.
Word. I hear it. I hear it. It gets pretty hard. I mean, any like school institution, the like bureaucracy that governs even the most liberal leaning, quote unquote, is going to be a conservative bureaucracy, unfortunately, in my opinion. Would you talk a bit about, we mentioned this before a little bit at the beginning of the interview, but would you talk a little bit about the rates of incarceration for women and female assigned people? And for listeners who are unfamiliar with that term, I'm talking about using the word female assigned to include any trans or gender nonconforming folks within that umbrella. In the United States, how have these rates increased in past years, and what are some of the reasons that you've been able to pinpoint for this increase?
Sure, yeah. So right now, in terms of people who are in women's facilities on the state and the federal level, there's something like over 215,000 people locked down in women's facilities. And since 1980, there's been a 700% increase. So sevenfold increase from how many women were locked down in 1980 to just a couple of years ago. And a lot of the increase, what we're seeing is that more women are being incarcerated for violent crimes, but also drug and property crimes. And I think that, you know, in terms of this increase, that actually far surpasses the rate of increase for men. So even though men are numerically, you know, they have more numbers imprisoned, women's rates have been, you know, skyrocketing past them because they're getting prison terms and jail sentences a lot more than they were previously. And so, you know, what's really happened is that there's been this increased crackdown on women's survival crimes. And I also include violence in that. A lot of the crimes that are committed by women are, you know, simple assaults, which can sometimes mean self-defense, but not always. And so whereas they were sort of paternalistically let off the hook in previous decades, now we're shifting towards a sort of gender-neutral carceral system that is interested in punishing women just the same as they punish men. And I'm in no way advocating for, you know, this sort of paternalistic leniency again. I'm interested in reducing and eliminating incarceration for any person of any gender identity. But basically, that's what has happened. And I think it's really interesting that this increase started in the 80s during a time where, you know, crack cocaine was a huge moral panic. And, you know, all of a sudden what you see on the media, right, are crack babies and Black women's bodies as a sort of, you know, dysfunctional reproductive organ, I guess. And so in terms of, you know, Black women being pathologized as, you know, breeding a whole new generation of super predators or, you know, hyper criminal Black men who were born as crack babies was definitely something that was hyped up, you know, in political discourse and in the media, and something that was actually encoded in law when we look at, you know, a lot of the increased penalties for crack cocaine. And so when I try to explain the increase, you know, it's definitely not tracking the fact that women are using drugs more, because actually they're not. They're using at similar rates. But it is that the state is locating a threat in certain racialized bodies, especially women's bodies, who are sort of, you know, considered to be the bearers of criminal men.
Definitely. It seems to me that, and this sort of ties into a subsequent question that I want to ask you, but it seems to me that this topic, even within like anarchism or like anarchist discourse or like far left liberal discourse, even is somewhat invisibilized or somewhat like not really spoken about. Do you have a similar experience with that? And if you do, like what do you think is going on there? Apart from totalizing misogyny and like totalizing like sexism?
I mean, you know, I feel like, again, the sort of images we see and the people who are being policed, I mean, there still is a majority of men who are being arrested and men who are incarcerated. And so, you know, I guess that would sort of lead people to sort of throw down support more for men. Additionally, just in sort of rolling with like political support crews who do work for either political prisoners or prisoners who have been politicized, you know, is that, I guess, politicization is sort of defined narrowly. And so oftentimes they're looking at the people who will start the riots or start a major hunger strike or a work stoppage. And unfortunately, you know, the spotlight just isn't on the kinds of resistance that are happening in women's facilities. I mean, at the same time, like, you know, we saw a fire set at an immigration detention center for Latinas in Texas about a year ago. So it's not that they're not doing it, but I also wonder about why the spotlight isn't necessarily on that, you know, or why, you know, killing one's rapist or killing one's abuser doesn't automatically fit into the political category. But I think, you know, in conversation, many people recognize it. It's maybe not yet widespread.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were talking about it, it made me think of how different, you know, modes of resistance on the street are prioritized. And it seems to me to be an extension of the same thing, like very, for lack of better words, hyper-masculinized or like macho activities like rioting or, you know, like smashing a window or something like that are given much in the way of airtime and things that might, again, for lack of a better word, might be like slightly more feminized, are not. And yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that that I'm sure we could list off in a laundry list, but I don't know if that would make for very interesting radio. You talked about strikes and resistance in women's facilities. Are there any current ones that you would like to give airtime to?
Dang, that's a really good question, because I'm working on some of the work stoppage stuff right now. And the biggest struggle with that has been that we haven't quite yet gotten any women's facilities on board or like major organizers who are reaching out from women's facilities. You know, of course, I'm going into prison just about every week, but can't seem to get something going. So yeah, in terms of a shout out or a plug, I don't really have it. I mean, honestly, that's what Unstoppable Publication was meant to spark. So hopefully in September, we'll have that fixed.
Definitely. And is Unstoppable mostly focused on like people in women's prison and trans women?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah. So Unstoppable Publication is, again, a project that's meant to highlight the resistance that's usually unhighlighted.
Gotcha.
Especially among women and trans women.
Word. I guess on that note, I was really interested in asking your opinion on this thing that's been on my mind for a little while, which is, so seemingly there's a high level of at least like nominal visibility regarding and discussion concerning trans feminine people who are incarcerated, at least within the anarchist and like far left activist scenes. I'm curious about the seeming lack of discourse regarding trans masculine and female assigned gender nonconforming inmates. Do you have any insight about this as someone who has been focused on populations within women's prisons for a long time?
Yeah, sure. And I don't think that I have a quick answer for that or necessarily a well thought out answer for that. But I think that in terms of the visibility that trans feminine folks are getting is that, you know, oftentimes when trans women are incarcerated, even if it's just jailed on a short-term basis, that they're put into men's facilities, which puts them at a huge risk, actually 6 times the risk of being sexually assaulted. And in men's facilities especially, we see that, you know, one of the ways that the state operates and exercises control is by state-sanctioned sexual assault. And we don't see that as much in women's facilities. And so I wonder if it is that, you know, the lack of visibility that trans-masculine folks are getting is that their experience of incarceration doesn't include such grotesque, you know, forms of abuse. And that when, you know, I've talked to transmasculine folks, they actually prefer to be, if they were to be incarcerated anywhere, they'd prefer to be in a woman's facility because they consider it to be more safe. But safety is still bracketed for them because trans men or trans masculine folks experience most of their abuse while incarcerated at the hands of correctional officers, which is also the same for cis women too. Most of that abuse is coming from COs who are either just sort of heckling people or sexually assaulting people.
Gotcha. Do you think that, I also don't have very many well thought out or thoughts that would come out as like well phrased things to say about this, but I was wondering about, because society's tendency as far as trans feminine people go is like at the best like forms of tokenization and forms of fetishization in one way or the other. Do you think that that's playing into it at all, or like what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So wait, say more about that. So let's say trans women are fetishized in a way that trans men aren't?
I would say so, or like spectacularized. And what I'm talking about is specifically in media. Spectacularized and like the plight of the you know, trans woman of color and like all of these things are like very visibilized. And my colleague, like, who's listening in right now, brought up the really good point that perhaps visibility in women's prison, as far as trans women go, too, has skyrocketed because of that show Orange is the New Black, and that very highly spectacularizes prison populations and all that stuff. I'm not sure if I'm making any good sense, but does that clarify things a bit?
Yeah, it does. And I wonder if just the, the trans feminine is, like you said, spectacularized and also sort of heralded as much more of a major transition, you know, as opposed to, you know, a trans masculine person who might still be considered by some as just to be a tomboy, right? So, I think that plays into it, and I'd love to talk through that more, but I don't know if I have any more clear answers either.
Yeah, certainly. Maybe we could save it for some time that isn't the radio. Because, I think it's a very, like, interesting discussion, and I think there's a lot going on there, and I'd love to have more people participate in this discussion and see where more people are at about it.
Yeah. And even I looking through, and I'm sorry, this is really quick, even looking through the Black and Pink, they put out a yearly LGBTQ prisoner survey. And in terms of their respondents, I don't even see any trans men, like, you know, explicitly identified trans men responding to that survey. Every person I've encountered who's in a women's facility and who others might classify as like, oh, that's a trans man or trans masculine, they call themselves like, ah, no, I'm just a bulldagger, or like, I'm a boy girl. So there's a different like set of linguistics going on there that doesn't fit neatly into these newer categories.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, I wonder what Marius Mason would have to say about this, who is a very highly visible trans masculine prisoner he's been in prison for quite a number of years now and is transitioning in prison. And also, like, I think you bring up the good point, a really solid point about identity, because I also used to work with the Transmission Prison Project here in Asheville, which is a prison books program that specifically sends books to LGBT people. And number one, we never really sent anything into women's facilities. We never really got any requests. Maybe 1 in 200 requests was coming from a women's facility. And never, ever did we write to any trans men. But perhaps this question of identity is something that is like worth exploring more. Like you said, maybe people culturally, like within prison, aren't really identifying as trans men. It's just like, I'm a bulldagger, I'm like a boy girl or whatever. I know there's some information out there, but it's a bit difficult to find.
But I mean, I think it would be great to reach out to Marius and his support crew too, you know, just to sort of like see, like, well, you know, what do you know about it? Maybe you can write something about it.
That would be really cool. Would you talk some, because I know you wrote in the zine quite extensively about your work in a so-called rehabilitation facility called TTC.
Mm-hmm.
And would you talk about the myth of rehabilitation and about how it relates to your experiences working there? I was also really interested in your discussion in this section of the zine about the tension between empowerment and disempowerment. I was wondering if you had any words to say about that.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that, you know, what I call the TTC, it's a nonprofit, community-centered agency that provides material support somewhat, but also psychological support for people, specifically women coming out of prison or jail. And right now, that seems to be a really popular mode for the state to exercise power, because as different states are having these budget crises and realizing that, you know, locking people up with long prison sentences is economically untenable, they're trying to shuffle more people through community-based agencies like this that say that they're, you know, rehabilitation focused and that they provide, you know, trauma support or whatever. And so, you know, here we have something that's pushed through at this point by both liberals and conservatives as, you know, the solution to mass incarceration. And, you know, what I saw happen there is that it was this weird phenomenon where the counselors there, basically the people who worked at TTC, were social workers. They used to have some counselors who were incarcerated themselves and were, you know, sort of sharing their experiences and helping to counsel people, but they ended up sort of getting the boot, and this agency started to become professionalized and rely more on professional labor and social workers. So why I call it a strange phenomenon is that they sort of sympathized with women and understood incarceration to be a poor response to some of the crimes that these women did or to their lives. They thought that these women should have never been in jail or prison in the first place, and that they should have always stayed in the community. So they recognize on some level the sort of unjustness of their situation, but they also heavily demonized the lives of the poor women who were attending the center. And so they didn't have a lot of material resources. They used to be able to give out, you know, bus tokens for people. They used to help people sort of get linked up with jobs. But as the city was sort of experiencing, you know, post deindustrialization and this shrinking economy, they were unable to help people materially. And so what it transformed into was this center that offered group therapy classes. And so people getting out of prison were on parole. There were some people on probation who were mandated to go to the center, attend so many group therapy classes, and then they would successfully finish their probation or parole. And these group therapy classes really focused on women fixing their minds and sort of cognitively restructuring themselves. And I argue that, you know, ultimately what they're doing is that they're trying to get women to adjust their mental spaces to the abusive conditions of state violence, of capital. So oftentimes the women who went there had a huge struggle to sort of get themselves back on their feet and to get a job. So many of them, you know, had doors shut in their face over and over again. And the agency, the community agency, TTC, would say, you know, don't have a bad attitude. Don't get down about it. and if the woman did, you know, experience, you know, some grief and try to express that, they were immediately shamed and told that they had to fix their mind before their lives would get better. And so in terms of the dynamics that was going on at this agency, they framed a lot of things in terms of empowerment, right? We are going to provide you the tools for you to empower yourself. Now, mind you, this didn't include a job. This didn't include, you know, linking women back up with their children. This didn't include bus tokens, which were totally crucial for them to get around town. What this did include was empowerment through better psychological health. And this better psychological health was defined very narrowly. And the starting point was that women thought themselves into their bad circumstances, and so they can think themselves out of it.
That's so, so, so diabolical to me. Like, it just seems it's such an erasure of so many things, and also just is asking people to kind of just like brutally conform to statist standards of like what it means to. It reminds me of like conversations I've had with friends about the mental health industrial complex and barriers that people face when tangling with that structure and all of these things. And I remember this particular story you told in the zine about this one Latina woman who was on the bus and she got called a racist and a sexist slur by somebody on the bus, and she ended up, I think, punching him in the face or something. And she brought this to the group, and the counselor was just like, oh, you had like wrong thinking about that. You know, you need to just, it's almost this like pseudo Christian framework of like, oh, you just need to turn the other cheek or whatever like that. Is it a Christian like organization at all? Or
no. It's very much not not religiously affiliated, and actually started off as a feminist social work agency in the 80s. I mean, they were doing a lot of like free needle exchanges and handing out condoms to sex workers on this major street in the city. But over time, as they started to, you know, increasingly get more and more state funds and grants, they had to become a little bit more legitimate. And the more legitimate they got, the less that they could promote, you know, self-defense. And the more that they got on this, you know, weird sort of liberal bandwagon of saying, hey, you really can't control racist or sexist structures. You really can't affect change to this one guy on the bus who calls you a racist and sexist slur. And so instead, sort of get right in your mind and the rest will follow.
Yeah, that seems to be, I don't know, I've seen so many times where, you know, the state funding just completely goes in and kills any kind of even like liberal agenda, any kind of even just like even like liberal bent. And it seems to me that that just totally ignores like any material reality that might enhance a like psychological condition or like a, you know, forms of like social stress or anything like that. And the discussion between, you know, empowerment and disempowerment or empowerment in this state or within TTC actually, or you have a discussion about it as it relates to like actual personal disempowerment. Would you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. I think that for me personally, I felt quite disempowered by the remedies that were thrown, you know, my way when I was trying to get my head clean and sort of, you know, get out of these underground economies that were really self-destructive and harmful in so many ways. And the avenues that I was provided were these sort of frameworks where you had to admit powerlessness and sort of, you know, proclaim that again, that you can't affect, you know, change in that way. And you sort of have to accept the way that things are. And I think that that loses so much of what I know to be a truly empowering framework, right? When we think about liberation-based empowerment and sort of redemptive models that are informed by social movements, right? And the ways in which we can think about ourselves as a sort of a community of people who can, this reframing of empowerment and this co-optation of the word as being purely psychological loses so much of its collective roots. And so really, I think the focus should be on criminalized people sort of pushing back against these state actors and state forces that are trying to define their lives as pathological or as dysfunctional, because ultimately that's an imposed definition that just quite frankly isn't true. And so there's some, you know, I don't know, I think that there's some hope there in terms of rejecting the psychological and the mental health industrial complex and sort of honoring the way that we have to survive.
Definitely agree with that. Maybe on that tip, would you, you mentioned that you conduct a class in prison. You mentioned this at the beginning of the interview, the Webbs class. Would you talk a bit about that? How did it start and what are its aims and how has it been for you having to interact within the prison system, with the prison system in this way?
Sure. Yeah. So Webbs started about 2.5 years ago. I and another person, another outsider, we were just really, you know, interested in seeing what we could do to support women on the inside. At our local prison, they didn't have any domestic violence programming. And so we, you know, wanted to sort of change that, but also not sort of meet the needs that the prison administrators had for the women on the inside. So the weird thing about going into a prison on a weekly basis is that oftentimes you have to make these concessions or at least code your language to get the class approved to begin with. And so we said, hey, we want to come in, we want to do domestic violence programming. And when we finally got the okay, you know, here we were sitting in a room full of survivors of some kind of violence and sometimes perpetrators of some kind of violence, and basically asked them, you know, what do you want? And we knew that not only did we want it to be steered by people on the inside, but we also wanted it to have a political component. And when I say a political component, I also want to be clear and include highlighting, you know, the personal as political as well. So we were really interested in pushing people to sort of think about different radical frameworks and how their lives might intersect with those. But we also wanted to meet people where they were at the same time. So there's, after doing this for 2.5 years, there's this constant push and pull where sometimes I'm like, you know, raising my black flag, like on a political bandwagon, like, let's do this. And, you know, and then there are times where the women are telling me to, like, you know, slow down. You know, there's still very much sort of open and raw wounds that they have to deal with. And so the experience has been super sort of humbling and enlightening and interesting to, again, try to find that balance of collective liberation and also personal healing.
What is the structure of the class like?
It's a 12-week curriculum, and the structure changes pretty much every cycle because we like to follow sort of a popular education model where, again, depending upon the group of women who are there, we try to, you know, again, see where they're at, what they want to get out of the group. And so this last class that I did in particular, I'll just, you know, give you an example. In the very, very beginning, they knew that they wanted to create a newsletter for other women in prison across state borders and throughout the U.S. And they wanted it to be focused on violence, trauma, and they wanted their poetry in there. And they wanted me to put in some poetry that I could find from outside writers, and they drew some artwork. And so it's this like 20-page, like full color, zine, essentially, that talks about state violence, interpersonal violence. And so that newsletter really tracked the entire 12-week course where we were learning about all these things, but also producing our own commentary on patriarchy or heteropatriarchy or state violence, etc.
Do you have any recommendations for people who would like to start similar classes in their own areas?
Yeah, in terms of resources, I don't know anything that's posted online. I would be happy to circulate anything that I've written up for my class and just sort of send it off so people could email me if they want. You know, yeah, again, I don't know if, let's say, Critical Resistance or any group like that has an online proposal posted, but it's actually easier than you think, and I would definitely hype that avenue up for people who are interested.
Definitely. And how can people get in touch with you if they'd like to do that?
Oh, they can email me at firehawk666@riseup.net.
Awesome. Would you talk about how your experiences conducting ethnography regarding prisons have shaped your views on activism and like modes of engagement with this topic?
Yeah, sure. So I think, you know, in the very beginning of doing ethnography and like formal academic research, I was really interested in documenting women's experiences with incarceration, but also violence, private violence, public violence, all of that. And I soon after realized that it was this sort of oppression porn that was playing out in my writing that I felt inherently uncomfortable about. And even though I myself had experienced some of it or have some deep familiarity with some of it, it still felt sort of uncomfortable because of the audience who would be reading it, you know, mostly other academics. So I then started to shift my question to, you know, how is the neoliberal state sort of constituting itself in women's lives? And in terms of doing ethnography, I now am trying to like what they call like study up, right? And try to identify the powerful players who are exercising control over people's lives instead of simply putting the analytical gaze on people who are experiencing oppression. I think that there is, you know, you can sort of do a mix of both, but I definitely want to interrogate systems of power first and foremost. And in terms of the second part of the question, well, all of my ethnography has been done outside of the prison walls. And I am trying to play around with the idea of doing research in prison, but I'd be interested in like participatory action models where, you know, the people on the inside are really asking the questions and also answering the questions themselves, where, you know, they might be doing the research, they might be interviewing each other. And so I think that's something I perhaps want to do, but I have to think about that a bit more, especially as someone who is essentially an outsider at this point and who, you know, bears a lot more privilege in the relationship.
An outsider in the sense of like being outside of prison?
Yeah, what I mean is, you know, being outside of prison and being so removed from my own experience of incarceration and, you know, being an academic, I now have more institutional credibility that makes me a bit more like socially distanced from people who are currently incarcerated.
How can people find your zine, Governing Bodies, Governing Souls, and the Unstoppable publication? Are there some websites for that?
Yeah, for Unstoppable publication, you can go to unstoppable.noblogs.org. And in terms of the zine, I can send you a link to that because I don't have that website
cool.
in front of me either. Or people can email me and then I can just mail it out to them as well.
That's awesome. Firehawk, those are all the questions I have. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, that's it.
Awesome. Yeah. Hey, thank you so much for coming onto the show. It's been a total pleasure talking to you about this topic.
Yeah, thanks so much, William. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Firehawk about her zine, Governing Bodies, Governing Souls. If you would like to read a copy of this zine, you can either email her at firehawk666@riseup.net, or you can go to the website insurgenttheater.org/hackett. hackett.pdf. And if you are interested in interfacing with the WEBS class, visit our blog at ashevillefm.org/the-final-straw for the Facebook link. And for the Unstoppable publication, again, you can visit unstoppable.noblogs.org to order a copy and to learn more about this project.